Welcome to another episode of Million Dollar Stories, where we get to interview authors from all over the world. I'm excited about this one because this is her first podcast talking about her book. So we're going to go easy on her, guys. Don't you worry. Anyways, if you're out there and you're looking to write a book or maybe just kind of be a little stronger in your arguments and maybe see how two different data sets connect or maybe don't connect, this book might be for you. We're talking about an individual who wrote a book called The Chicago Guide to Writing about Multivariate Analysis. And you might not know what multivariate analysis is, but it's basically, it involves evaluating multiple variables, more than two, to identify any possible association among them. So if you're trying to convince somebody about maybe a solution, or maybe there's that a problem that's out there, if you get very good at this technique, I think you'll become way stronger as a an individual who can communicate your message much more clearly. And so the author today is with us, Jane Miller. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's start off with the genesis of the book. Why did you sit down and write a book about multivariate analysis?
Okay, so I'm a college professor and I teach at Rutgers. I teach in the School of Planning and Public Policy. I teach a lot of courses where students have to use numbers to answer questions. Right? This isn't just abstract math. This is trying to forecast something or look for a cause and an effect. And what I found was that my students were having a really hard time. Like, they'd write a sentence and they'd stick a number in it, but you couldn't tell why it was there. It's what I call a naked number. And so trying to help people say, well, if you're trying to help a policymaker or a public health practitioner understand what your results mean for their practice, they might not be a statistician. How do you explain that to them? Mm-hmm. And I realized no one had ever taught my students how to do it. And then I stepped back and I realized no one had ever taught me how to do it. So over the years, I've been really lucky. I had very good professors who taught me various things. And then I just started to notice, like, that communication was really clear. That communication was really confusing. Let me not do that. And so I started writing guidelines for my students. And then my colleagues were like, you know, hey, Jane, this would be really helpful. Have you ever thought about writing a book? I'm like, no, I'm an article writer. I'm a researcher. I'm really comfortable with numbers, but I was almost put in remedial writing in high school. Like, writing was not my thing, but this colleague's like, you know what? Let's just get you a little bit of writing help. So she helped me find an editor who helped me see, okay, explain all these principles up front, and then you can carry them through the book. And once you do that, it'll be more clear. And so I pitched it. The Chicago Guides to Writing, Editing, and Publishing is a well-known writing series, and a colleague connected me up. So that's how the book got started.
Man, yeah, and we've published about 339 books so far. We're working with probably 70 or 80 in the pipeline. And every once in a while, they're trying to tell a story with numbers. So I think whatever you share with us today will be additional for our editors and ghostwriters too. So in the book, though, you do talk about seven basic principles. Mm-hmm. What are these basic principles that you need to apply to keep things simple and clear for the reader?
Yeah, so it starts really basic. It starts with, in fact, as a confidence builder, I like to point out the things that are in common with other kinds of writing, because a lot of people are kind of math phobic. So the first principle is to specify the W's, which you learn in journalism class. Who, what, when, where, how many. Because numbers don't, in the real world, they don't make sense if you don't know who they pertain to or where they belong to or that sort of thing. So that's one. The most valuable one in the book was on the margin of my dissertation. My dissertation chair wrote it. He said, always specify direction and magnitude of an association. That sounds really jargony, but basically it means if you got two numbers, which is bigger? How much bigger? Don't just tell me two things are correlated. Don't just tell me two things are associated. Help me see, like, as income goes up, obesity goes down. Okay, so direction and magnitude is, direction is up or down, higher or lower. Magnitude is it a teeny little difference or is it a big difference? So sometimes, like, multivariate analysis is a form of statistical analysis. So one of the other things the book talks about is, I don't know if you've heard, Mike, but statistical significance, is that something that you've ever learned or been taught about?
I think I've learned it. I don't know if I apply it too much, but yeah.
Yeah, so here's what happens. People learn it. And what the basic comparison you learn to make is there's this thing called the p-value, and you learn to look at whether it's less than 0.05 or not. And what I've noticed is once my students have learned that, they think that's all they have to talk about. Was the difference statistically significant? Well, but we need to know, is it a big difference or a small difference? Like, if it's a really small difference, are you going to throw a lot of money and time and effort to fixing a problem to get a teeny improvement? Or do you want to find one that's going to give you a bigger improvement? So that's where direction and magnitude matter a lot. So that's one of the other really important principles. And then the principles carry through. So like the things that I teach in the first book I wrote, which is Writing About Numbers, we're literally talking about addition, subtraction, division, percentage, change, things people have learned by like fifth grade. So the math's not hard, but people are really bad at explaining the answers. And then in the Writing About Multivariate, I show how that applies to these fancier statistical models, regression models. I'll give you the names just so you, if anybody out there recognizes them, linear regression or logistic regression. They're basically a form of subtraction and division. And once people see that and they learn how to write about it, all of a sudden, things that only people with the same advanced degree as the author could understand, all of a sudden, regular people who just want to know the answer to the question can understand. That's the goal. I mean, yeah. I tell my students, one of the principles that you are teaching things is like, okay, you want a grandmother-friendly sentence. You want a sentence that your grandmother, who does not have an advanced degree in statistics, can understand. Maybe not the p-value. That will let slide, but they should be able to understand the topic, the question. Was it a big effect? Was it in the direction we affect? What would that mean? Like if somebody's trying to fix health or improve the environment, is this a good way to go about doing it? You're trying to show the answer to the word problem, not just the word problem.
Yeah. And I once heard this great quote, effective writing is not about showing people your ideas. It's about changing other people's opinions or something along those lines. And so you could put all this great statistical information in there, but if it doesn't give them a clear-cut answer or maybe give them a perspective that they haven't thought of or open their mind in some capacity, it's not effective. So what you're saying is that the biggest problem most people run into is they try to speak at too high of a level, right? Or they try to connect too many dots that the average reader doesn't understand. Like you said, your grandmother doesn't understand what a p-value is. So if you do not lay it out in a way that maybe an individual at 13 or 14 year old level doesn't understand, it's not great writing. And I teach our writers that, hey, the average or most successful book out there, even the greatest speeches, are written at about a 13 to 14 year old level, specifically to make sure it lands amongst the audience. And so is that the biggest issue? Is that people speak too highly?
It's funny because some people are like, well, if my readers are smart enough, they'll be able to understand
Bingo.
What I'm saying.
Yeah.
Right? And I'm like, no, if you're smart enough, you'll be able to explain it to somebody who's 13 years old. The basic idea, not all the technical stuff behind it. You know, you got to know it. You, the author, if you're writing about a multivariate model, have to know about it. And they need to trust, yeah, Jane knows what she's talking about. Once you do that, you're trying to make it as easy as possible for them to understand the point. You're not trying to show off your vocabulary. You're not trying to show off your stats. You're trying to make the point across. And one of the things I have a hard time convincing my colleagues sometimes is they feel like they have to write using all that technical terminology or people won't take them seriously. My thought is in the middle of the paper, you use that. But at the beginning and the end, or if you're giving a presentation, you want to make it as accessible as possible to anybody who's interested in the topic, even if they don't like stats. They could hate stats. Mm.
And I guess maybe the best way to put this is, you know, whenever you tell a story, not everybody remembers the entire story, but they remember key points. And so when you tell a story with numbers, you want them to be able to remember it and then share those numbers with someone else as if they are the expert. Am I right? So you have to highlight.
Yeah, you want them to understand what is the question you're trying to address with the numbers and what is the answer. You don't want them to have to go do the homework. I tell the other metaphor I use a lot is when you're writing a paper, you're not writing an exam that your readers have to do all the math and all the thinking to figure it out. You are telling a story where you have put the numbers there and explained what they mean. So you're writing the answer, you're not writing the problem set. You're not writing an exam question, you're writing the answer.
Mm. I always bring up, and this is in my book, Million Dollar Book, but I talk about two different case studies. I love representing case studies because it shows my point very well. Whether it's tracking how rats go through a maze and how fast they do it, And based off of either the two variables, whether it's they're starving or they're afraid of a cat, you're able to track it. And you don't remember everything, but you just remember the outcome. And if you could do that in numbers, it solidifies your point, and therefore they trust you as they progress through the book. Or whether
like
it's...
If you wrote, the people, the ones that were scared of the cat did it in 12 seconds, and the ones who, I forgot what your other thing was, took 15 seconds. Somebody has to figure out which one took longer, how much longer. If you say the ones who were scared of the cat did it 3 seconds faster, you've given them the answer.
There it is. That's what I mean. That's exactly what we've done.
That's exactly it. That's what you're looking for.
Yes. And so all you're trying to do is whether the number does mean something, but the point is what needs to shine through. So you do talk about, and I think this is part of the principle pathway, I guess, simplicity, plausibility. Is that those are part of the principles, right?
Plausibility is whether a number makes sense or what it's supposed to be measuring. And my other book, which I just published more recently, which is called Making Sense of Numbers. Think about it. That's exactly what plausibility means. Does something make sense? So that whole book came out of a rather unfortunate situation. A student that was in a program, I wasn't her mentor, but I was working with her, and she came to me. It was the 9th week of a 10-week program, and she was running an analysis of birth weight in grams. Well, as you probably know, most Americans don't know grams from anything. It means nothing to them.
Right.
And she was getting an average value of like 7,000 grams and a maximum value, a lot of 9999s. And I said, do you know what 7,000 grams translates to? Do you know what 9,999 grams translates to? And she goes, no, I don't know grams. Well, it turns out, just to cut to the chase, 9,900, that's 10 kilograms. That would be a woman giving birth to a 22-pound baby. So when I tell that story, every woman in the room cringes because that's the size of a one-year-old, okay? And so what happened was this student didn't bother to look that a 9999 in that data set meant there was a value was missing. The mother hadn't given the answer. So what she didn't realize was 999 wasn't plausible as an actual birth rate in grams for an actual human baby. So the whole book came out of what questions do people have to ask themselves to figure out whether this number makes any sense. She had to redo everything, excluding all the 9999s, so that then her data were like, you know, the average baby weighs about 7 pounds when it's born. So realizing, oh, I had the wrong data. I was interpreting it wrong. It wasn't plausible. A lot of people are so afraid of numbers, they don't even look at them and say, does this make sense?
Mm. Yeah, you have a question.
So very different issue, but it's super important. It's super important.
You have a question here. Are precise values important? And I like the phrase that you put in here, and I guess this is popular, but a chart is worth 1,000 words. I mean, anytime you have pictures in there, it does solidify your point. But when we do books and there is a clear-cut chart that the author gives us so we can publish it for them, you could have that on one page and it will do more than maybe a chapter will. Like, right?
Here's the thing. There are a lot of instances, especially statistical, where people do expect the precise values. If you don't put them in there, you won't meet the standard. So the idea is you have to pick the tool to suit the objective. If somebody else needs to know your precise values, you put them in a table. Then when you're trying to show the general shape of the pattern, maybe you complement it with a chart. So if you're writing an infographic for a general audience, you're not going to put a coefficient with 4 decimal places. Nobody's going to care about it. It's going to confuse them. It's probably going to scare them off. So an infographic for a general audience, I would probably make a chart. If I'm doing a table for a peer-reviewed journal article in biomedicine, I'm absolutely going to create a table that has precise values in it. So you have to know your audience and how they're going to want to use your numbers. And then you say, okay, do they need precise values? Do they need general shape? Do they need both? And then you make a decision about how you're going to present it. It's not one size fits all at all.
Man, that makes so much sense from my background in school. The moment that, do you remember a thing called PJAS in school? Do you remember that at all?
No. What is that?
I think it was something about junior academy or whatever. Anyways, there would be students that would be selected within classrooms and they would do presentations. And I remember them doing presentations on the effects of shampoo or effects of growing grass. And the metrics to me, it didn't mean anything to us kids, right? It was like 0.00, whatever. And like you said, if it's not relevant to the audience, it has to mean something. There's got to be a picture that pops in their brain when they hear that number. And if mm-hmm. it doesn't land, you have done a poor job. And it might make sense to you and to potentially people in your field, but you know, you're knowing your audience. The average person that comes to us is most likely speaking to the masses. So you have to break it down into numbers that actually mean right. something often, to the reader.
Numbers that mean something. And often there's a comparison value that helps. Like if I don't know what on earth they were measuring with the shampoo, foaming time or percent of oil that it removes from your hair or whatever, but help them understand what the number you want is. So an example that I use, it's rapidly becoming not a good example, but even a few years ago, like A1C, that measure for people who have diabetes, what number should it be? Do you want it to be higher or lower? What Bingo. Is the target value? Now there's so many commercials on TV where people are saying, I got my A1C below 5 point, whatever. Now people have a clue. But a few years ago, like if you had said your A1C is 8, I would have said, is that good or bad? And if it's bad, do I want it to be a 9 or do I want it to be a 6? So helping people know, like, is there a threshold you're trying to get below? Is there, do we want something going up or going down? Do we want something in the middle range? So helping people, and this is really important for authors. Don't make your readers go scurrying off to find that threshold. You put it in the paper or you do the comparison yourself, right? So you have two bars showing which rats went through the maze faster. Just showing the comparison of their times is good enough. But let's say you're trying to pass a test. What is a passing score? You have a little bar and you show where which student scores are above it and which student scores are below it. And now everybody can understand it immediately. Right?
Mm. Yeah.
So there are different tools, tables, charts, and words, and they have different strengths. So usually when you're writing a paper or an infographic or giving a talk, some things, if it's just one number, you can usually do it with a sentence. If it's a comparison, especially with a lot of numbers, you're going to want a table or a chart, but then you explain it with words. The words is how you ask and answer the question. And the numbers are there like, okay, here's the data. And now I'm going to interpret it.
Yeah. I think that the more I do public speeches and whether I get on podcasts, the goal is to condense all of that information down to as few words as possible. Therefore, it lands. And if it lands and you look like you know what you're talking about, they trust your words going forward, which increases your ability to lead and manage, right? So whether it's your team or whether it's the clients or whether it's customers or an audience, you need to do this in as few words as possible and as clear as picture as possible. And I love good. Okay. You have something in here that's super important. I love how you did this. You actually give examples of like what's poor writing, okay mm-hmm. writing, and great writing. All right. So here's an example, guys. I love this. Poor. The relative hazard of failure for material C was 0.78, right? Nobody knows. There's no context. There's no if it's good or bad. Here's better. Under simulated conditions, the best performing material C, lasted 1.2 times as long as the next best choice, material B. All right, now I'm starting to see a little bit more. Now let's go to the best. In conditions that mimic the weather and volume and weight of traffic in Little Town and Midville, the best performing material C, has an average expected lifetime of 64 years compared with 50 years for the next best choice. It's very, very, like 1.28 doesn't mean too much. It means a little bit more than the original, but a 6 year or 14 year difference. I got it. Now it makes sense, right? It's these little changes saying pretty much the same thing, right?
Yeah. So the idea is, the reason I started the poor, better, best is all my principles are kind of abstract. So the one I told you a few minutes ago, always specify direction and magnitude of association. People nod their head and they think it's so easy. You know, I say, which is bigger? How much bigger? And they go, yeah, I got it. And then I show them all those mistakes, all the poor examples are taken from literature somewhere. It could be an ad on a train platform. It could be a journal article. I'd sometimes tweak the topic so it's not obvious whose mistake it was. But the idea is, I'm showing them in a concrete way, what do I mean by that mistake? Now, how do I make it better? And then how do I apply that principle to make it even better? So, whatever the principle is, you just read an example. I don't remember what the principle was that was attached to it. It was probably about interpreting a ratio or providing context. So the idea is a lot of the things I teach people, when I explain them live, they think they got it. And then if I have them practice, they have a really hard time with it. So the poor, better, best is trying to walk them through to see, oh, that's still a mistake. It's good, but it's not as good as it could be. How do we make it even better?
Got it. Now, I think you have certain topics on like which tools to use. I guess maybe you teach this within the book, but like charts or graphs, pie charts. I mean, is there one that it's probably dependent on whatever you're trying to convey, but is there any really effective go-to way of showing numbers that you have come across or what you recommend to start with?
So it completely depends on the objective. So there is no one answer. And my students, I'm teaching research methods right now. They could tell you the answer to this question. It all depends on what's called level of measurement, the type of variable or measure you're using, and how many variables you're looking at together, and what the point is you're trying to make. So I have a student right now who's doing an analysis, really interesting. He's looking at change in medical debt for people who have cancer. And so he has a chart that diverges. These are the ones who had a decrease in medical debt, and these are the ones who had an increase in medical debt, and they're opposite colors, and they're going in opposite directions. So it makes a really strong point about who saw a decrease in medical debt and who saw an increase in medical debt and how big were they, okay? But if all you're doing is you're trying to show, what percentage of the sample has medical debt, that's a very different kind of chart. Or if you're trying to show how does this thing change over time, that's another kind of chart. So there is a book, I didn't know about this until I wrote a more recent book. There's visualizations are really common now. There's a great book by Evergreen on visualizations, and she's got on the inside covers a cheat sheet. Like, if this is what you're trying to show, use this kind of chart. If this is what you're trying to show, use this other kind of chart. So you want to keep it as simple as possible. You want to keep it as uncluttered as possible. But the types of charts vary a lot depending on if you're doing a multivariate, presenting a multivariate result. It's very, very different than a distribution. Like, everybody's seen a bell curve. They have different purposes.
Well, and this is probably a very technical question, and maybe you've come across an answer, but I would think that the average person's attention is just dropping drastically because of all the distractions in the world, whether it's social media or whether it's just the inundation of advertisements that they receive on a day-to-day basis. So if they don't get it within X amount of time, or if X amount of brain power is required to get it, it's almost like they just ignore it right out of the gate.
Exactly.
So, do you have any data or science behind what you need to do in a certain amount of time?
Okay. So again, if you haven't interviewed her, you might want to talk to her. Her name is Stephanie Evergreen. She's the author of this data visualization book. She has a whole chapter on what's called cognitive load, that how long it takes somebody to process something. And people have done tests that show people have a harder time at comparing the sizes of wedges than they do the heights of bars, and people have a harder time. So there's all of this psychological testing that's been done to say, if you need to get the point across quickly, use this kind of tool, not this kind of tool. And she's also really big on declutter the heck out of your chart. Like, visualizations, remember back in the day, like in middle school, when you learned how to make graphs for science, you learned how to make a legend.
Yes.
She actually often has you get rid of legends and instead use color coding in the chart itself. Like, the words are the colors that match the bar color in a rhetorical question or an answer. But the idea, you're right, people's attention spans are very low. You don't want them to have to work too hard. Part of it is the whole, social media and people's attention spans are down. But part of it is, I think they lose faith. They're like, this is meant for somebody who's smarter than me, or this is meant for somebody who has a doctorate in statistics, and then they don't even try. So it is really important to work on, how do I convey my point as quickly as possible? Is it a sentence? Is it a simple table? Is it a certain kind of chart? And tables probably would be my last choice for most lay audiences. They know how to read them, but it's pain. Charts are much better at direction and magnitude. Which is higher? How much higher? Which line is going up? How steeply? Oh, this line's going up. This other line's going down. you know, you can see that better than when you're sitting there looking at a row of numbers and having to do the math to say, oh, those are going down. Right. So charts are better for that kind, conveying that kind of thing.
So what was the
tables? However, I sound like I'm dumping all over tables. Tables are super important for statisticians. People absolutely expect your reader asked or viewer asked about precise values. There are audiences where if you don't put in a table with precise numbers, you will have no cred. So for a scientific audience, you absolutely would need those tables. You want to make them well. Many people make them really badly. There's a whole chapter on tables for those of you that are interested in that. So it isn't that there's any one tool that is universally bad. You have to figure out for your particular objective what's going to work best.
And the book that you recommended by that woman that you were referencing, what was the title of it?
It's something Data Visualizations. It's a Sage publication.
We always ask our guests of if there's a book out there you recommend outside of your own one. So
yeah, I just wrote that down. So when I wrote the second edition of writing about multivariate, when I wrote Making Sense of Numbers, I completely modified what my old charts chapter to build in visualizations because there are a lot of new current techniques that are much more user friendly than the old fashioned class, you know, types of charts. And that was almost all based. I teach courses based on that data visualization book too.
So I know that, I mean, we work specifically with business related or personal development books. Is there, and this is probably a loaded question, but is there a number that you should shoot for, you know, whenever it comes to whether it's data sets or visualizations charts to put in your book? I mean, it probably varies from topic to topic, but whenever I think of books that really mean a lot to me, like Rich Dad, Poor Dad, I think of maybe the cash flow quadrant. I think of one picture, maybe two pictures in that book that stand out that when I think of that book, it solidifies why I love it so much. So there is a way to overwhelm the reader. And I'm thinking maybe you have two or three very significant pieces of data that shine through in the book and maybe that's it. Is there any number you should shoot for or is there no number?
I don't know that there is. I think it's going to depend who are you writing the book for? What is the book about? You know, there's somewhere you're going to want to put a lot of photographs because that's going to evoke the context way better than any other diagram you could do. There are others where a meme would hook people's attention. So I really wouldn't give a universal answer. Journals, the kinds of journals that I write for as a professor, they usually have limits on how many exhibits you're allowed. So you have to be really strategic about how you use them. But I think for people writing a book where they're trying to get a certain point across, you just ask yourself, is this a diagram? Is it a cartoon? Is it a chart? Is it a sentence? You know, what is the way that people, oh, now I get it. That's what you're trying to communicate well. So figuring out which is the best way, best point for that particular task.
Yeah. And I think that the most effective books are the ones that you could read and then share with other ones as if you wrote it. I think that's probably the best way to put it because nowadays I will teach the cash flow quadrant. I didn't come up with the idea, but it's so clear for me to educate other people on it that that's effective writing. When you can do that in a way that makes you the authoritative figure in the field just by reading it, it makes you look so good in front of other people. So yeah, make it as clear as possible for you. And I guess this depends on whatever you're teaching, but if you can make it so memorable that you could actually educate others on it, you win.
Yeah. So if I could put in a plug, the second most beneficial principle in the book, direction and magnitude is number one. And I know this based on feedback. Okay. Direction and magnitude, people come to me and they say, this paper, I was trying to get it published. It wasn't getting published. I used your principles and then it got accepted like that. Or I gave a presentation and people are like, what did you do that was so clear? So that's the single most valuable. Second one, which relates to what you were just talking about, is to take the time to organize. This is going to sound really boring and really trivial. It is not. Organize the data in your charts to support however you're going to describe it. So don't put things in alphabetical order just because you learned to do that in first grade. If that's not the order you're going to explain them, put them in that order. So usually we're describing things in themes, like these are social factors why people might want an abortion. These are health factors why people might want an abortion. Or this is the most common reason people agree with. This is the least common. So there's an empirical order, like highest to lowest, is one way that people would usually write something up. And another way is organized into themes. And instead, what most people do is they put it in a completely arbitrary order. And so then when they write it or they're trying to explain it, like you were just talking about that quadrant, they're explaining it in an order that doesn't match the diagram. So your readers are having to figure out what's going on. They can't follow you. And often if you put the data in the right order, all of a sudden the story becomes super clear, super clear. So as geeky as that sounds, it makes the writing much more powerful. And I think this will pertain to people who, if they're really barely using numbers, right? They're using maybe a count of favorite pizza topping flavors or something like that. If you put them in rank order, or you put them in, these are the veggie ones and these are the meat ones, now you can make the point that you want to make instead of having people go, you know, pepperoni, then plain, then, you know, veggie, then this. If you're zigzagging their eyes all over the page, it's confusing. If it's, here's the order I'm going to write about them, here's the order I put them in the diagram. So again, I know that sounds geeky, but people have told me repeatedly how much that clarifies their communication.
Do you classify yourself as basically a storyteller? I think we're all storytellers to some degree, but is that how you look at yourself?
I think I have become one more because I've realized, I mean, one thing, you read one example from my book. If you read the whole thing, my examples are drawn from a lot of different topics. And what I do is I pick an example that I think people can relate to. So sometimes it has to be technical because it's illustrating a technical point. But like you nodded instantly when I brought up A1C and diabetes. It's like, oh, okay, I can see how that would fit.
Yeah.
So I tell stories that I think people can connect to. There's a talk I give often trying to help people understand what statistical significance is and isn't. And it has to do with a study, it's pretty old now, on the association between how much time teenagers spend playing video games and how much time they spend doing more quote unquote developmentally appropriate things like hanging out with their friends or reading books. And I make the point, well, you know, there is a statistically significant difference in reading time by gaming time, but it's like microscopic. And the point that I make, which always gets a laugh, is, okay, we're trying to get boys to read more. Cutting back on video gaming is shown to do that. How easy is it to get a teenage boy to give up their Game Boy for an hour every day? Right? Parents will instantly relate to that. Recent teenagers will instantly relate to that. And when they go, wow, even if that were a big, good way to get them to cut back on their reading, I'm never going to succeed at getting them to drop that Game Boy. So it's a story that helps people see, instead of me saying, is the independent variable malleable? That's the technical way to say it. If I say, can we get boys to change their gaming behavior? That's a story that will help people understand the point better. So I try to pick examples where my students, you know, they laugh, or like the women in the room cringing at the idea of giving birth to a 22-pound baby, or parents going, I am not going to try to get 2 extra minutes a day of reading time out of my son by taking his Game Boy away for an hour. That's just not going to happen. So those stories become important. It helps make it less intimidating because it can be an everyday topic. So yeah, I try to tell stories.
Yeah. I just think that if the better you are at telling stories, the more people, pay attention to you, they trust you more, and you can actually get the outcome that you're seeking, right? Whether it's a client or a student. So storytelling is absolutely a skill set that I believe people should try to master. Last question I have for you. A lot of our clients and myself, we're always trying to get speaking gigs, all right? And I'm trying to even get a TED Talk on the hero's journey. We're talking about storytelling. The hero's journey, you're probably aware of it. And I want to communicate it in such a way that it lands. So anybody out there who's trying to now become a speaker, what would you say to them when it comes to maybe portraying, you know, a multivariate analysis? Obviously you probably touched on a few things, but anything that if there's nothing to be shown and you're just communicating it verbally, are there any pointers that you would give to us?
I'm trying to think of a circumstance. Okay, so it's as if I ran a multivariate model analysis and now I have to present it to a lay audience, because otherwise, if I were doing it at any other place, I would have slides with diagrams and tables in them.
Correct. Yeah. No, so question. Let's just say absolutely you do not question. Have that, and I'm on a stage and all I can do, and maybe I do have a slideshow, but let's just say you're going naked, as you said before, right? Naked number. So let's,
No, I'm not going naked numbers. I'm going naked slides. No
naked slide. All right. So what happens there? Any pointers? Cause I think this would be a great takeaway for anybody listening or watching right now.
Okay. So with something that technical, the key is you're talking to a lay audience. You want them to understand what is the question behind it, not some technical thing about p-values and confidence intervals. What is the real world question you're trying to answer? And then you convey that, and then you, there's in the book, there's whole chapters about how to present the numbers in ways that are in sentences and not scary. So it would be unusual for somebody to be giving that kind of talk with absolutely no diagrams. You know, but if, let's say somebody wants you to do that, I would say, would it be okay if I have like one diagram? Because if you're trying to portray a numeric result, one thing that's really hard, people can't keep numbers in their heads.
Right. That's another thing I think of.
You cannot expect them to do that and then follow your story. So you might say, how about if I just have a static display behind me that's got this one diagram on it? And then you introduce it and you say, what we're really trying to understand here is whether this, or what happens with this. So we did this analysis, you know, here's who we studied, and this is what, and now when you turn around to it, I actually have a whole technique I use called Vanna White. Those of you that are of a certain age, you know who Vanna is.
Oh, I know. Every guy had a crush on Vanna White, so we all know, yeah.
There we go. Okay. Yeah, I teach a Vanna White technique for how do you explain an exhibit live, and it's like Vanna, you're doing this the whole time. You're showing your audience. So you've got your one diagram up that puts the results in a form that a regular old person can understand, and you explain it. But you're telling a story where you're asking and answering the substantive question, and the numbers are just, they're the evidence.
Got it.
You're not going to snow them with a lot of detail or technical stuff. Because if somebody asks you a technical question and you know the rest of the audience isn't going to be interested, you say, you know, I'd be really happy to talk with you about that afterward. You know, it's technical and I want to give you a good answer, but I don't know that everybody else is interested. So you don't want them to think that you have no idea what you're talking about and that you're trying to get out of it. But like, I had a student ask me a very technical question in class the other day. And it's like, if I answer this, the rest of the class is going to kill me. So I will happily talk to her later. You know, it's a great question. I'm glad she's curious. So being prepared with the more technical answer, but recognizing that there in front of the rest of the audience is not the moment to do it.
Got it. Yeah. And my assumption is if it's a number that you want them to remember, there are probably certain techniques to apply, whether it's saying it multiple times or getting them to think about that number as they're listening to speech or your speech.
Yeah. So maybe you can give a threshold, like this is twice the poverty line, or this represents, you know, this number, the number of refugees has tripled in the past year. Oh, okay. Because if you just tell them it's 100,000, that's a big number. Does anybody know what that means? So like I was just reading the New York Times this morning and they're talking about asylum seekers and how many have been led into the US. That number would have meant nothing to me without the context. So yeah, you're not going to give them a million numbers, but you're going to talk about how much it's changed or whether it's a way above, like, is it a record high? The number that they did a great job. New York Times always does. This is the lowest number in 3 decades. This is the highest number in since blah, blah was enacted. So give them just enough, but that can be part of your storyline. And then you have your one diagram up there.
Great. Yeah. I just think that you're talking about getting boys to read. If I knew the importance of number one, communicating a message, or how important it is to read so you have the understanding to communicate a message, or if I read certain personal development or business books, how it benefits me pretty much automatically, I would have started reading very, very young. But I didn't start reading really until I was 22, 23 when I read that book. So yeah, okay, once you see the benefits of it.
You got the hook and you got hooked.
You that's right. Changed my life. Anyway, is there a website or a social media channel that you recommend people to look you up on outside of picking up your books on Amazon?
So the basic description of me, I'm on LinkedIn. I'm Jane Miller. I'm at Rutgers or my Rutgers website. I don't do much other social media. I do ResearchGate. ResearchGate is great because all my publications are there. They're listed. Many of them they can download. Like a lot, the books, you would have to buy the book. But there are articles that cover parts of it that you could download there for free. So Jane Miller, unfortunately, is a fairly common name. So I think putting it with Rutgers would be important. And that's probably your best bet. But I'm also Rutgers, the Blaustein School of Planning and Public Policy is where you would find me.
You know, for your first podcast, you're so articulate. You were able to clearly communicate so much of your book easily for us lay audience. So thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate your time. And hopefully the people listening or watching are going to become better storytellers with numbers. So thanks so much for being here.
Yep, thanks for inviting me.
Remember, guys, $1 million book will lead to a $1 million life. Right on.